grab another coffee if you need it. So, when I was doing missions work, we did a lot of work with youth and with young people. And I remember one particular event. We were running kind of a residential away weekend at a Christian retreat center for this Christian school that we'd been working with. And we had multiple activities and events planned throughout the week for the kids. But if you've ever done youth work, you'll know that the highlight of those events were always the after dark events, the evening events that we would do where the lights would get knocked off and they get to run around wild and crazy in the dark. If you've ever done work with kids and with young people, you'll know that any opportunity to do stuff like this and sort of let loose a little bit is always a good time for them, and that was always the highlight of the day, always the thing that they would look forward to. I wish I could say that we worked hard to rein them in, but that's not really the case. We egged them on, and we encouraged them, and we kept pushing them, and it got a little bit more ridiculous and intense throughout the week. I know for a fact that more than one person ended up in hospital that week. Probably not the best overall, but at least early on in the week, we managed to keep things mostly reined in. And what we found is that even the most mundane activities and events, somehow if you turn the lights out, become a whole different level of excitement for them. One evening, one of the early evenings in the week, we had this team activity built planned for them. It was kind of a bit of a team building event. We divided them up into three or four different teams and designed the most difficult obstacle course that we could. And then we had this brilliant idea that what we would do, we would have like one kid come in, the team leader would come in and have a look at the obstacle course in the light, and then we'd knock the lights off. And they'd bring the rest of their team in, and their job was to guide the team through this obstacle course in the dark. Of course, even though it was a pretty simple activity, things quickly got out of hand. The rules, we kept them as simple as possible. Do whatever it takes to guide your team through the obstacle course, and you'd get penalties if you kind of knocked over any of the obstacles we'd built, or touched or moved any pieces of the course. And the idea is that, at least in our mind, that it would give people early on in the week a chance to work together, to build trust with one another as a team, to get to know one another a little bit better. In reality, all it did was give them an excuse to run around like wild, crazy kids. That's just the nature of the beast, I suppose. But it did seem to fall into a pretty familiar pattern. First few teams, they did their best, but it usually didn't take long before it began to fall apart. They would usually ask us things like if they were allowed to touch their teammates, to have them hold hands, or if they could move through the course together, all of those things. And our answer was simple. We've told you everything you need to know. You can do whatever it takes, but there's a penalty if you touch or knock over the obstacles. Those were the only rules we put in place. After three or four of the first few teams had gone, everything was pretty close together. It took them roughly maybe 5 to 7 minutes to complete the course, pretty consistently, and then there was like 15 minutes worth of penalties for everything that they'd knocked over and damaged. That was just kind of the way things played out. Even the guide who'd seen the course, by the time the lights went out, it was nearly impossible to give them any meaningful instructions. It really was the blind leading the blind. For the final team, we reset the course, and we're expecting the same outcomes. The group leader came in and started to look around the obstacle course that we'd set up for him. But instead of looking at the obstacle course, he only paid attention to the room, to us. He was looking as we made our way around the room. He followed us as we went over to the light switch and knocked off the lights. As soon as his team came in, his response was simple. You said I can do whatever it takes to help my team get through the obstacle course. Well, here it is. And he switched the lights back on. Of course, the team they completed the obstacle course in minutes, there were no penalties at all. It seems incredibly obvious. But the best way to overcome the challenge wasn't to stumble around in the dark together, but to shine a light on the situation. This morning, that's what we're going to focus on. Just one verse in John chapter 8. We'll unpick and unpack the rest of this this chapter a little bit more next week. But as we kind of begin this, I just want us to focus on this one verse, verse 12. It happens in the same context as some of the stuff we were thinking about previously. It's all part of this Feast of Tabernacles, Feast of Booths that Jesus had been attending in Jerusalem with his disciples. And he's been interacting with the Pharisees and the religious leaders and the Jewish people. And it picks up here in verse 12 when we read these words. John chapter 8, beginning at verse 12. Again, Jesus spoke to them, saying, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. It's an incredibly short passage, but a passage in which Jesus says three incredibly important things. Things so significant that they'll provoke the Pharisees to call him a liar, to challenge him on his very identity and who he is. That's what we'll think about and unpick and unpack next week. But before we do that, I want us to understand these three things that Jesus says, these profound truths that he leaves his people with. These truths are both about him and also about us and what it means for us living in the world as his people. Let's start perhaps not with what he says implicitly, but with what he implies. That the world is dark. The first part of his claim is it's implicit rather than stated explicitly. Jesus doesn't come out and say, the world is an incredibly dark place. He doesn't need to. People, they know this, they understand this. It's impossible for anyone to miss. When God created the world, he calls his creation good, and that essential goodness is never lost completely. The world continues to be God's good creation, this place where he rules and reigns. But we live with the reality that sin has entered the world, and in some ways the goodness of God's creation has been shrouded in darkness. One of the great messianic passages in all of Scripture, Isaiah chapter 9, it speaks about people who walked in darkness and dwelt in the land of deep darkness. Indeed, the very festival that they were celebrating, it was a reminder of the darkness that that God had led his people out of. It was a reminder of their time in the wilderness, their time where they had been in captivity. All of these things would have been in their minds throughout this. They would have been aware of just how dark and difficult the world truly can get. So Jesus alludes to the fact that without him, people will continue to walk in darkness. They are lost, without direction. Dr. Andreas Kostenberger, he's an author and research professor at Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. He's also the theologian in residence at Fellowship Rally Church. He summarizes it this way. Jesus said that, in truth, they don't see where they're going. They're morally and spiritually confused and without clear direction, as I was when I was lost in my sin, before I met Christ. But even though they walk in darkness, people in the world are loving it. They love the darkness. They'd rather stumble in the dark than come to the light. In fact, Jesus puts it even more strongly. He says that they hate the light. Why? Because their works are evil. Our instinct might be to push back against this fact. I think certainly the world will try and convince you that people are inherently good, that they don't love evil, that we recognise evil for what it is, and that we don't embrace it, we don't love it, we don't glory in it. Surely people don't really love evil, wickedness and sin, do they? Do people really hate the light? I think most people in the world, if you were to ask them, would say, no, not at all. I'm essentially a good person. Maybe I do some bad things from here, from time to time, here and there. But for the most part, I'm pretty good. I know what right is. I know what wrong is. We recognise wickedness and evil and call people to account when they do it. Most people, I think, would say they don't love darkness. Yet evidence seems to point to the contrary. This very month, Pride Month, as it's so often called, this month we see companies tripping over themselves to rainbow wash their logos to show their pride over what is, effectively, sin. As much as we might try and convince ourselves we recognise the darkness for what it is, evidence would seem to point in the other direction. But of course this is a knife that cuts both ways. It may be easy for some of us to look at this and highlight something like pride and say that it is a celebration of wickedness. But of course there are so many other ways that people with different perspectives and opinions do exactly the same thing. How many people use this pride thing as an excuse to hate not only the sin, but also the sinners, to chastise, to cast out, to call them as something less than the image bearers of God that they truly are? So many of us are guilty of celebrating different kinds of wickedness. Jonathan Edwards, the Puritan theologian and revivalist during the first great evangelical awakening of the 1700s, he wrote this: "We ought to be very careful that we don't refuse to discourse with men with the appearance of a supercilious neglect, insignificance, as though we counted them not worthy to be regarded. On the contrary, we should condescend to carnal man as Christ has condescended to us." So often the world celebrates sin, and yet so often all of us find ways to embrace wickedness, hatred, evil, to find ways to otherize, to demonstrate hatred rather than bringing the true love of Christ to bear on all situations. But what is clear is simple. On all sides there is darkness, and outside of Christ there is a love of that darkness. People not only walk in moral and spiritual darkness, they even refuse to seek the light. They glory in and celebrate wickedness and evil time and time again. And so did all of us. All of us, in one way or another, were sinful just the same. Yet Jesus, he makes an incredible claim. He claims that not only is he a light, but in fact he is the light. Isaiah 9 again. The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who dwelt in the land of deep darkness, on them has light shone. When Jesus claims that I am the light of the world, he's making an incredibly exclusive claim. A lot of people, they're very comfortable with an inclusive kind of Jesus. The kind of Jesus who loved and welcomed everyone. Who only ever opposed the religious and the proud. Who loved people just as they are. Most people are okay with that Jesus. Colin Coward, a self-described Christian contemplative activist, he proposes a definition of radical Christian inclusion. And he bases it on Christ's life and ministry, at least how he understands it. Writing to the Church of England, he proposed that the Church should adopt this definition of inclusion. He says, radical Christian inclusion is rooted in God's unconditional, infinite, intimate love, manifest in the life of Jesus the Christ. We are all equally human, equally made in the image of God, equally loved, infinitely by God, all siblings in the rainbow family of God, equal members of the Church. The inclusion which comes through Christ's gift, integral to all humanity and all creation, irrespective of faith, culture, race, gender, or identity. There's a certain element of truth in that. God's love is for everyone. In some sense. But it also misses the point. A lot of people are okay with that definition of inclusion, of love, as long as we leave it there. Jesus is, of course, radically inclusive. His love is for all. He dies for all. He makes a way for all. But he's also radically and unapologetically exclusive. In other ways, Jesus doesn't just claim to be a light in the darkness, one light among many. He proclaims in no uncertain terms that he is the light. Given the context that he's speaking in, Jesus is likely trying to bring to mind Israel's time in the wilderness during the Exodus. In the book of Exodus, it says that the Lord went before them by day in a pillar of cloud to lead them along the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light, that they might travel by day and by night. The people of Israel, they understood that God himself was the light that led their path, that even in their time of Exodus, even in their time wandering in the wilderness, God had not abandoned them. He continued to give light for their path. And here is Jesus claiming to be that same light. This is one of the I am statements of Jesus. One of those statements where he assumes that divine name, the name that the Lord reveals to Moses in the burning bush. When Jesus says, I am the light of the world, he's claiming divinity. He's claiming the rights and the prerogatives of God himself. He's saying, just as the Lord led you in the wilderness, I am him leading you here and now. Jesus' love is for everyone. But it's also a love that demands obedience to him and to him alone. It's the kind of love that says, I love you where you are, but I love you enough not to leave you there. I want to lead you out of darkness, out of deception, out of sin. He claims to be the only true source of light, of life, of salvation. He's telling people in no uncertain terms that moral and spiritual clarity, that they are found in him and in him alone. He alone is the source of light, of truth. The only way to find true spiritual clarity is through him. We live in a world that is incredibly confused about the sources of truth. We live in a world that will tell you that if it's true for you, that's all that matters. Be true to yourself, and that is enough. But is it really enough? I don't know that it is. In fact, I'm certain that it isn't. But here is the good news, the important truth for all of us. That he does not leave people walking in darkness. What does that mean for us? I think so often when we think about these things, when we think about light and darkness, good and evil, we treat them as if they're these equal and opposite forces. That just isn't really the case. I think Jesus uses this analogy very intentionally. Because I think the way we'd like, that we often like to package it, is this idea that light and darkness, they are in some ways in balance, they are some ways equal in power, in authority, in significance. But experience tells us that isn't the case. If I go into the deepest, darkest corner that I can find, if I gather up all of the darkness I can from that, if I get a big box and I seal up the box and try and keep all of the darkness inside the box, then I bring it up into a light room and open that box, does the room become any darker? Of course not. The darkness, not in an ultimate sense, can never overcome the light. In fact, the darkness can only exist by hiding from the light. The darkness only exists where the light isn't shining.
Like a shadow.
That's it. No amount of darkness that I can gather up will extinguish the light. Not in an ultimate sense. When light comes into the darkness, darkness simply cannot remain. Light completely overcomes it. When we light a candle, when we turn on a light, darkness simply disappears. When exposed to the light, it must flee. So when Jesus calls himself the light, he's making a statement not only about himself, but about us and the world that we live in. Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. Jesus is the light, yes, and as we follow him, we no longer walk in darkness. Darkness is exposed and revealed in the light. It's driven out and sent fleeing. That is the nature of how darkness and light interact. Again, to quote Andreas Kostenberger. So what does it mean for you and me that Jesus is the light of the world? I think essentially what it means is that Jesus shines his spotlight on our sinful condition so that we can see ourselves in the light of his holiness and righteousness. I'm sorry to say, but in God's eyes, we're like rats in the dark who, when you suddenly turn on the light, scurry in every direction to run away from the light. I know that doesn't sound very nice and complimentary, but it's true. Now, the real question is, what do we do when Jesus shines his spotlight on our sin? Do we move towards him or away from him? What John tells us is that naturally our sin nature causes us to hide from Jesus' presence, just as Adam and Eve did when they hid from God, when they sinned in the garden. It's only by God's grace that any of us turns to Christ and comes to the light. John elsewhere says that Jesus draws us, and that unless God draws people, no one can come to Jesus. So, do you and I come to the light? Do we come to Jesus even in our sin and desperate condition? If you're not a believer yet, would you come to Jesus? He loves you and died for you. When people ask Jesus, what must we do to be doing the works of God? Jesus replied, this is the work of God, that you believe in him who he has sent. 6:28 and 29 that we thought about a few weeks ago. All you need to do is repent and believe. Or if you're a Christian, when you sin, do you come to Jesus? You know he wants you to come to him, even and especially when you sin, because he loves you and died for you, so you can be forgiven. So do what doesn't come naturally, and what may seem counterintuitive. Come to the light. Come to Jesus. He will receive you and forgive you. That's grace. And here's perhaps the most fascinating part about all of this. As we come into the light, Jesus says something about us. Speaking in John here, he's clear. Jesus says, I am the light of the world. But that's not all he says about the light of the world. See, in Matthew 5:14 and 16, he says something else. He says, you are the light of the world. That's speaking about believers. A city on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand, and it gives light to all in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. The light we know, that we experience, we understand, we do that because Jesus has shined his light on us. He reveals truth and enables us to walk in the light free from darkness. And as Jesus gives us his light, we are then called to reflect that light to the world. As we continue to walk in the light, he gives us his light. And then we are called to live a life of light that reflects his glory. When Jesus said he's the light of the world, he means it. In an ultimate sense, only he brings that light of life and salvation. Only he reveals the truth and overcomes the darkness in an ultimate sense. But when he says we are the light of the world, he also means it. He's not saying that we're the light in the same way that he is the light. None of us can save anyone. None of us can even save ourselves. We rely on him, we depend upon his light. But as children of the light, we then have a responsibility to bring that light to the world, to let that light shine before others, to be a beacon, a city on a hill, a lamp on a lampstand, letting the light shine as he has given us his light. We let it shine before all. I once heard a pastor preacher say that our job as Christians is to be like the moon. On a bright night, you look up at the sky and you see the light of the moon. And of course, the moon gives no light of its own. All it does is it reflects the sun. And that is what we're called to do likewise. We as his people are called to reflect the sun, to let his light be visible in how we live our own lives, to proclaim him and make him known, to bring his light into the darkest places, into a world in desperate need of hope. That is the call of the believer. That is what it means to be his people. That is what each of us is called to do. So how are we being called to do it? What dark places is Jesus asking you to bring his light? What difficult situations is he asking you to bring his truth into? What darkness is he asking you to be a part in exposing and revealing for what it is and watching it flee as his light overcomes all obstacles? As his people, we have a responsibility to bring the light to the world. Let's reflect his light.
Amen. Can I say something?
Yeah.
We started with the rainbow.